It is Thursday, February 25th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, North Korea faces the prospect of new international sanctions within days as punishment for its recent nuclear and missile tests. Our UN correspondent will tell us exactly how tough those sanctions could be. A Mideast analyst will explain why he thinks Iranian President Rouhani may be disappointed with the outcome of Friday's parliamentary election in Iran. And we'll speak to VOA Music's Nikki Strong about her experiences at a major gathering of social media experts in New York City. It's all ahead on International Edition. The UN Security Council is considering unprecedented new sanctions against North Korea in response to its January nuclear test and February rocket launch. The two North Korean moves violated four sets of existing international sanctions imposed on Pyongyang. The United States submitted a draft resolution on a new round of North Korea sanctions to the UN Security Council a short time ago. Our UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has been following the developments, and they asked her how ready the council members are to proceed to a vote.
Well, I think they are ready because the main players in this drama are the United States and China. And the U.S. and China have worked for 7 weeks together to draft this resolution. It's technically a U.S.-drafted resolution, but they had a lot of input from the Chinese on it. So the U.S. and China have gone over it together. If the Chinese accept it, I don't see that any of the other 13 council members will have a big objection to it. There's some question whether Russia might agree to it. They don't like sanctions generally, but in the big picture of things, they need China, and China needs them, so they'll probably go along with it.
And what kind of sanctions are in this resolution?
Well, Ambassador Power spoke to reporters this afternoon after she circulated it in the Security Council in a closed meeting, and she said that there are very unprecedented measures in it, very tough measures, including, for instance, total arms embargo, which includes conventional weapons, which have often been used to generate revenue for North Korea for their illicit programs. It also, the resolution will also seek to impose a mandatory inspection of all cargo that goes in and out of North Korea, whether it's by land or by sea or by air, and that includes everything. I mean, food items, everything, in and out. So things are being, the screws are being turned tighter, shall we say, and there's going to be more banking sanctions, and there are also going to be sanctions on items such as refined petroleum, aviation fuel. So this could shut down the North Korean rocket program because they wouldn't have fuel to put in their rockets to launch them. So there's some really new and innovative sanctions here.
How are the members of the Security Council dealing with the long-running concern that tightening the screws in North Korea will really just hurt the people rather than the regime?
Right. Well, Ambassador Power was very clear in saying that these are sanctions that are intended to target the government, but not the people. They know that the people have suffered enough, and the government has chosen to, you know, put all its money on building its nuclear and ballistic missile program instead of feeding its people. So the U.S. and the international community don't want to make that situation worse.
Is there any sense of how this resolution will be enforced?
There are new enforcement mechanisms in it, but, you know, it's up to countries to abide by Security Council resolutions. They are international law, and yes, I know many of them haven't been enforced before, and, you know, we've had four rounds of sanctions on North Korea that haven't really made a dent in the situation. But if countries, you know, if this is fully implemented and fully enforced, they hope that it really will be a game changer.
And you expect to vote on this when exactly?
In the coming days, we're hearing possibly Saturday or Sunday. Countries have to take it back now, look it over. It's a long resolution. It's a very technical resolution. So even though we're not expecting any major objections to it, you know, you have to give countries the right of looking at it and deciding what they want to do, the council members.
Sure. So we will watch out for that this weekend. Thanks so much to our UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir, for updating us.
Sure, Michael.
Well, next we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, with us in the studio to give us the online reaction to our top story. Hey, G, how's it going?
Hi, Michael.
Well, which handles, Twitter handles, do you recommend following to get the buzz on these developments?
So I think the latest news is from the U.S. mission to the UN at USUN, and that's quite prolific on Twitter, as you can imagine. It's retweeting from the U.S. ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, and also sending out some original tweets. Power is on Twitter at Ambassador Power, and her latest tweet about North Korea reads like this. We remain clear-eyed on hashtag DPRK regime's nuclear ambitions. The proposed resolution sends unambiguous message. There will be consequences for their actions. The North official name is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK.
Those are strong words. What are the U.S. mission's original tweets like?
So one of them is a breaking tweet which notified its followers that Washington's proposed UNSC resolution on North Korea would represent the strongest set of sanctions imposed by the UNSC in more than 20 years. The UNSC stands for the UN Security Council. Twitter users in general applauded the move, but some are asking for more. One person asked, any plan to actually help the residents there, or is everyone fine with keeping up the charade of sanctions?
Well, I'm sure Washington and Beijing don't think it's a charade.
No,
but,
not at
they,
all.
They did agree on this. It seems like they have agreed on this sanctions resolution. Now, what are we hearing from China about that?
So, yes, they did agree on it, and they say they did. People in China can't access Twitter. As you know, they have something called Weibo instead. So it's quite hard to get a pulse on the public opinion. But here's what the state-owned CCTV News tweeted. FM, that's Foreign Minister Wang Yi. We are against the development of nuclear weapons by the DPRK. The Korean Peninsula must be denuclearized. And I want to add that our UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, whom you spoke with earlier, was live tweeting Ambassador Power's remarks on Twitter. Her handle is at mbashir, that's mbesheer. That's all for me today. Back to you.
Thanks, G. And if you want to follow G, her handle is at JEEABBEYLEE. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Michael_Lippin, as well as our show. It is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
It's been slow going at this construction site on the Greek island of Kos. This migrant processing center is a refugee hotspot, and locals fear what it could do to business. Resident Maria Kanto. She says, I believe the government should have examined this seriously. It should not have allowed for this to happen so as to protect other things, our economy above all. Financially challenged Greece is the main gateway for migrants from the Middle East, Asia, and Africa. The EU demanded Greece open 5 centers, and this being the final center designed for 6,000 migrants on an island with a population of 30,000. The locals have protested the center, and resident Ayana Grabani is concerned for a number of reasons.
Along with refugees, illegal immigrants who are dangerous also come. We worry for our families, children, and our jobs.
Recently, 6,000 more refugees flooded the island, but hotel bookings on Kos are down dramatically. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Iranians go to the polls on Friday to elect members of parliament and an 88-member assembly of experts. It will be Iran's first national elections since it reached a nuclear agreement with world powers last July, fulfilling a key policy goal of President Hassan Rouhani. Shahram Akbarzadeh is a Mideast analyst with Australia's Deakin University. Speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty, Akbarzadeh says Rouhani has not done enough to boost public support for his parliamentary allies.
Given that Rouhani has tried to steer clear of controversial topics in the country, it's really hard to see how there is a groundswell of support for his reformist agenda or for the reform agenda in Iran.
Why is that?
Because Rouhani has focused his policies on achieving a nuclear deal and freeing Iran from sanctions. As a result, he has left some of those hot issues like political prisoners, the fact that 2 of the former presidential candidates are in prison, are still under house arrest. He has left those issues effectively untouched because he didn't want to alienate the conservatives too much. So there has been a bit of political bargaining behind the scene. He has left those hot issues untouched, effectively left them to the conservatives. And in return, he's had a free hand in pushing the nuclear deal through. Because of that, I think a lot of disappointment in the country in relation to what he has not achieved domestically.
Of course, the nuclear deal has gone through, but I don't think the average Iranian on the street has benefited from any economic turnaround yet.
No, economic turnaround will take time, and that doesn't work for Rouhani because the average man in the street hasn't felt the benefit of sanctions relief. So the benefits will be incremental and they will take time.
I understand that for the first time, voters will have to select members of the 290-seat parliament and the 88 members of the Assembly of Experts. Can you explain who they are?
The Assembly of Experts is a very significant body because the Assembly of Experts has the portfolio of selecting the next supreme leader. And given that the supreme leader, Khamenei, at the moment is in a frail state, his health has been deteriorating. He's had a few medical procedures done in the past few years. There is a very good chance that the supreme leader will pass away in the lifetime of this coming Assembly of Experts. So the Assembly of Experts will have a very important task of appointing the next supreme leader. But given that the Assembly of Experts candidates for it have gone through a very severe screening process, vetting process, which has effectively ruled out a lot of reformist-minded candidates, I think it's a safe bet to assume that the Conservatives will maintain a hold on the Assembly of Experts.
And you've been listening to Shahram Akbarzadeh, a regional analyst with Australia's Deakin University, in conversation with International Edition's Victor Beatty. The first International Space Station crew to spend almost a year in space is about to return to Earth. The two-man crew of U.S. astronaut Scott Kelly and Russian cosmonaut Mikhail Kornienko have been taking part in the most comprehensive study so far of the physical impact of prolonged spaceflight in zero gravity. Kelly spoke with reporters here on Earth on Thursday about his experience so far. VOA's George Putich has the story.
Levitating gently in the middle of a room whose walls were covered with equipment, cables, scientific instruments and several high-end cameras with extremely long lenses, Scott Kelly talked about his life on board the International Space Station and the prospects of much longer space missions.
I'd like to, for the legacy of this flight to be that we can decide to do hard things and hard things that'll take us further away from the Earth, and this is one of them. And, you know, I'm hopeful, and I think we'll learn a lot about longer duration space flight and how that will take us to Mars someday.
Talking about everyday life, Kelly said the most difficult aspects of living in space are the fact that everything floats and the lack of running water. Not surprisingly, he said that the first thing he wants to do when he gets back home is to jump in his pool. The astronaut said that physically he feels very good, but admitted that it might be a subjective impression. Asked about psychological difficulties, Kelly said the only thing he really missed was physical contact with his family.
I don't know if I'd necessarily call it the psychological aspect, but there's certainly, you know, a loss of connection with folks on the ground that you care for and love and, you know, want to spend time with, that I think is a challenge.
The purpose of this year-long experiment was collecting data that would help astronauts prepare for deep space missions, such as a visit to Mars. When Kelly returns to Earth, scientists will compare his physical data to that of his twin brother, now retired NASA astronaut Mark Kelly, looking for subtle effects and changes. Kelly said one of his conclusions at the end of this mission is that living space on a long-term mission spacecraft will have to be much better designed.
On a trip to Mars, we're not going to have this much space, obviously. You're going to be in much tighter quarters. You're going to, you know, you're going to live, you're going to use the restroom, you're going to exercise, all within, you know, a few square meters of one another, I assume. You know, that's probably, you know, it's not going to be like the science fiction spaceship going to Mars.
Kelly says he thinks a trip to Mars is possible in the near future.
After being here for so long, that's one thing I definitely realize, that, you know, if we can dream it, you know, we can do it if we really want to.
Scott Kelly and his Russian counterpart, Mikhail Kornienko, are scheduled to land at Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan on Tuesday, March 1st. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Social media enthusiasts have been gathering in New York City this week for Social Media Week, part of a worldwide event being held in 18 cities over the course of this year. The event is drawing thousands of professionals in technology, marketing, and media, including VOA Music's Nikki Strong. She spoke to me earlier from VOA's New York Bureau, where she told me about her Social Media Week experience so far.
Well, I think it's great. It's been a wealth of information. It's made me think about social media in so many different contexts, politics, technology, culture, marketing. It was definitely worth every single penny coming. It's been a phenomenal learning experience. There's been a plethora of panels, everything from like how to effectively monitor your audience to like, you know, how social has rocked the live music experience.
How has it shaped the way you see your audience on social media? Because you're quite active on Twitter, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, you know what? It has made me realize that we have to reimagine how we see ourselves. All of us are brands now. We are brands. And keeping that in mind, especially as, you know, a media personality, really having to brand myself. What is my voice? What is my story? What is it that I am sharing with my followers?
And it seems like you're sharing a lot of GIFs at the moment.
Yes.
Those are quite colorful, aren't they?
Yes, they are a lot of fun. And that was actually inspired by, they had a panel on with the Comedy Central. And he talked about some of the campaigns that they had and what made them interesting and how their target demo are millennial males and how they love to share comedy. And as I was sitting there, I was like, you know, people love memes, they love GIFs. And so I started just tweeting with GIFs, especially since Twitter has now integrated that into the platform. So I'm like, high five Twitter. But it's all about making the experience much more fun and engaging.
And for people who don't know what GIFs are, these are these short looping video clips, right?
Yes, that are very funny. So they're like little animated things that kind of highlight what you're feeling or what you're saying. So they're like, you know, emoticons on crack, you could say.
Okay, well, what else have you learned through this experience of being at Social Media Week?
You know what? The key thing that I've learned, that the paradigm is shifting and is still shifting. So just as companies are wrapping their heads around Twitter and Facebook and learning how to measure, engage, and predict consumer behavior, new platforms emerge like Snapchat and Periscope, and new technology emerges like 360 imaging and virtual reality. And since visuals are becoming more and more important, like how do we do all of this when social media is saturated? How do we stand out? And one takeaway that I unfortunately had to face was that even though social media is free to use, to really make it effective, to make your brand stand out,
we got to spend money.
You have to spend money,
right,
to boost it. You have to, if you're really serious about, you know, standing out. Yeah, you have to make that investment. And a lot of companies, their budgets are changing, and more of their budget, the percentages are getting higher of their line items for social media.
And just quickly, before we wrap up, you learned also something about the way that the main presidential candidates are using social media, I've heard.
Now, this was fascinating. They had a panel on the election, and one takeaway was that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton operate in the like older traditional media paradigm. So they don't really get social media, so they're not as effective at it. They have other people handling it, so you don't really hear their voice per se. Whereas Trump, you know, created his brand in the age of social media, which speaks to how popular he is. He tweets his own tweets and they go viral and he gets all this press about it. And so it really shows that even though his audience is not just like millennials, he has been able to wrap his head around this social media. And it speaks to how popular social media is across the board.
He sure has. And I'm very jealous of you getting to be in Social Media Week, but it sounds like you had a great time. Thanks so much to Nikki Strong for reporting for us from Social Media Week in New York.
You're welcome, Michael.
Now on to entertainment. Movie stars will be gathering in Hollywood on Sunday for the annual Academy Awards, or Oscars. Some Hollywood observers have criticized the lack of diversity among this year's Oscar nominees, all of whom are white. But as VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports, Hollywood does have another side that is more diverse than the Hollywood film stars on display at the Oscars.
Cameroon-born actress and producer Constance Ijeoma is showing her film Ben and Ara at film festivals worldwide. It has a 2016 release date, so is not up for an Oscar. The film is a complex love story that tackles many themes.
Interracial, intercultural, interreligious. I think, you know, people can relate to all or one of those three things. So it is very relevant for our times.
Ben and Ara tells the tale of two graduate students, one an atheist and the other a Muslim. It deals with relationships, faith, family, and cultural tensions. A film called Echo Park stars Tony Okomboa, a British-Nigerian actor and producer. It's a romantic drama set in a changing neighborhood of Los Angeles that deals with universal themes of love and conflict.
I just want the story to be the important part, and the actors can be interchanged with any culture.
The 2014 historical drama Selma told the story of American civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. It won an Oscar for its original song, Glory. Its director, Ava DuVernay, is distributing Okomboa's film through a collective that she founded. She is a rarity in Hollywood, a mainstream director who is African-American and female.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Academy Awards nominees, class of 2015.
This year's Oscar nominees are overwhelmingly white. Tony Okomboa says the problem goes beyond individual movies.
While there were some films that could have been recognized this year, I still feel the bigger issue is there's not enough films being made that have diverse characters in them.
Financing and distribution are difficult. But Hollywood films are being made by international and minority artists.
And I think we do have a responsibility, people in my shoes, to continue telling our stories, regardless of whether or not we have the support of the mainstream to get it out there.
The filmmakers say the mainstream industry and award shows like the Oscars have some catching up to do to reflect the diversity that is already present in the industry. Ben and Ara has upcoming festival showings in Venice and in Cameroon. Echo Park has theatrical openings scheduled for Los Angeles and New York. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. Today's show is brought to you by director Tracy Carter and engineer Zaina Abdelrahman. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thank you also so much to our Facebook audience for all your kind words. We'll see you again soon and have a great weekend.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Hafiz Abdul Rahman Maki is a fugitive who was wanted for his role in helping lead the radical Lashkar-e-Taiba terrorist group dedicated to imposing strict Islamic rule over parts of India and Pakistan. The organization is believed to have organized and conducted the November 2008 attack on Mumbai, India, that left 166 people dead, including six American citizens. For his actions, the U.S. Treasury Department listed Maki as a specially designated terrorist and has imposed sanctions on him. The United Nations declared his group an international terrorist organization soon after the Mumbai attack in December 2008. A Pakistani citizen, Maki was born in Bahawalpur, Pakistan, in about 1948. He is known to have used the alias Abdulrahman Maki. The U.S. Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $2 million for information leading to Maki's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.